From California to Ohio, Wisconsin to Alabama, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, with many school districts opting out of in-person classes, parents are looking for alternatives. In South Carolina, a new school choice program is set to launch. Ellen Weaver from the Palmetto Promise Institute is here with details. Efforts at a fourth stimulus to blunt the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic have fallen victim to partisan dysfunction. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. COVID-19 has dented many state budgets, but some states were in financial trouble even before the pandemic. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why they should not get a federal bailout. And U.S. Senator Ted Cruz held a hearing this past week on how legitimate protests against racism have been hijacked by Marxist radicals. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It is the time of year when students typically prepare to return to the classroom, but the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic is preventing that from happening in many school districts. So parents are looking at alternative ways of educating their children. Ellen Weaver is president and CEO of the Palmetto Promise Institute. She joins us to talk about a new school choice program in South Carolina. Ellen, welcome to American Radio Journal. Ellen, as we see parents and school administrations all across the country trying to decide right now how the fall school season is going to look, tell us a little bit about the opportunity that this presents for various school choice programs around the country.
We have just seen a real hunger on the part of parents to have access to safe and flexible options for their student for the fall. As a school choice advocate, we've said from the very beginning for years that one size just doesn't fit all. And I think that this pandemic is highlighting that in a very real way that perhaps the general public has never seen before. And so we see a real chance to advance this idea that a parent is in the best position to make the choice for their child's future. And that's certainly what we've been working on right here in South Carolina.
Let's talk a bit about what you are doing in South Carolina. You have a new program, the Safe Access to Flexible Education Grant Program. Tell us a little bit about how that idea came about and what the grant program is all about.
Governor Henry McMaster has been listening to parents and the anxiety and frustration I think that they're feeling about what their child's education future is going to look like. Just like parents in every other state, I think that the parents in South Carolina are deeply concerned about the education learning loss that their children saw as a result of COVID. And so they're looking for alternative options, especially if their local public school is not going back to in-person education. Online learning is a great platform, but it just doesn't work for every child. And so like we've said, one size just doesn't fit all. And Governor McMaster thankfully had the vision to use these discretionary funds that he received under the Federal CARES Act to create what we're calling the SAFE Grants Program, the Safe Access to Flexible Education Program. And it's really modeled after programs that we have seen working for years in other states, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina. So this is really a proven model that allows a child to get access to an education that best meets their needs.
These grants, are they available to parents to use in any type of school, cyber school, cyber charter school, public charter school, parochial school? What can they be used for?
These particular grants are for independent or private schools. As you know, a charter school is essentially a public school, and so those are already free to parents to access. So this allows parents, and let me rush to say that the parent has to meet certain income criteria. So this is not a grant for a wealthy parent to keep their child in a private school. This is a grant for moderate to low income families to be able to afford that education choice that more affluent parents already have. So it allows many families who have been sacrificing even before COVID to put their child into a Christian or private school to keep their child there, as opposed to their family budget took a hit because of unemployment or just the economic fallout from the pandemic, having to pull their child out of a school where they might have been doing great in a school that they loved. So this is really about creating education flexibility and stability for these students who are from moderate to low income families.
Are you seeing an upswing in terms of interest in this grant program? How has it been received by parents and by students?
The demand has just been overwhelming. In the 2 weeks since Governor McMaster has announced the program, we have received inquiries from about 12,000 parents. We have over 200 schools who have signed up to participate, to be part of this program. And so there's definitely a very real need out there that Governor McMaster has put his finger on. Unfortunately, we're in a little bit of a holding pattern on the implementation of the program right now, because the folks who have opposed school choice for years, I like to call them the education status quo, quickly took the program to court. And while we're convinced that both the recent Supreme Court ruling in Espinoza, as well as prior cases like Zelman and other cases that have transpired here in South Carolina, put us on a very firm legal footing for the constitutionality of this program, you know, the other side likes to delay things and slow things down. And unfortunately, that's holding up real relief for parents who need it this fall. But Governor McMaster is fighting and fighting hard in court, and I'm convinced that he'll ultimately prevail on the merits.
Don't you find it interesting, if not disgraceful, that the education establishment, Alan, which is supposed to be there for the benefit of students, stands in the way of reforms, especially, as you pointed out, this program aimed at lower income students?
It's incredibly disheartening. I tell people all the time, we would like to think that education debates are about the children and what's best for students. Unfortunately, the tough reality is that it's about power and money. We could be doing one grant like this, and it would be one grant too many for those in the education status quo who are more concerned about holding on to the public money that they currently receive instead of really prioritizing what's in the best interest of the students that they're supposed to be serving. It is disgraceful. That's a great way to put it.
What is happening in South Carolina in terms of schools? Are they planning to have in-person classes, online, hybrid? What is the trend as we approach very rapidly the start of the school year?
It's a mixed bag here. We have a number of districts that are looking at hybrid models. We do have some that are going to 5-day in-person and at least offering that as a choice for parents. That's something that Governor McMaster has pushed very strongly for.
Alan Weaver is the president and chief executive officer of the Palmetto Promise Institute. We've been talking about a new program that is hopefully going to be instituted in South Carolina, the Safe Access to Flexible Education Grant Program. And Alan, tell us a little bit about the Palmetto Promise Institute, and also where can folks go on the web to read more about the Institute and about this program?
Well, I hope that they'll visit us at palmettopromise.org. Our organization launched about 7 years ago. I had worked, as we were priorly discussing, for Senator Jim DeMint, and he helped us start this institute when he retired from the U.S. Senate. And we're a think tank, essentially, a state-level think tank that advances free market public policy that we know will help every South Carolinian flourish. So education is one of our big issues, and we like to push what we call the Freedom Agenda, which is going to help every South Carolinian thrive.
Alan Weaver of the Palmetto Promise Institute. Alan, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
At the Club for Growth, we have Scott Parkinson joining us once again. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you every week, Loman.
As we have been discussing over the past couple of weeks, Scott, there are efforts between the White House and the House of Representatives and Senate to come up with a phase four stimulus plan here to deal with the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. However, they're having a great deal of difficulty coming to consensus. A lot of us see a lot of dysfunction on Capitol Hill. Is that really the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is pretty strong dysfunction. There's hyper-partisanship. We're so close to the election that right now members of the House and Senate from both sides are questioning whether it's even possible to come together and have a real negotiation that gets anything positive done for the American people in terms of relief on the coronavirus pandemic. The House Democrats, led by Nancy Pelosi, have really drawn their line in terms of making this a huge, huge package, the size and scope exceeding $3 trillion. This week, Pelosi said her number was $3.4 trillion. The White House has tried to keep the overall cost to under $1 trillion, while Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he thinks about $1 trillion would be the starting point. So hopefully that doesn't result in something like $4.4 trillion when you just add up everybody's priorities. But Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, and Mark Meadows, who's a former member of Congress from North Carolina and now the White House Chief of Staff, have been really meeting quite often with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And so they've sort of taken the baton in these negotiations, while Mitch McConnell has sat and allowed the White House to really take the posture for the Republicans. McConnell put out his marker on things that they wanted to see through the Senate leadership. We think that that obviously failed to promote pro-growth policies and really have a chance to do anything on the tax cut side or anything that was pro-growth and deregulation. They missed a major chance to advance parental choice and education. And so we're watching really closely to see what these negotiations look like. But it's really one of those things where they may have an agreement in principle. They may decide to stick around a little bit longer and keep working on this, or they may just go home for most of August and return in September and reevaluate where things stand. Because right now, the data on how much money exactly has been spent by different federal agencies from the large package, the CARES Act that we did this spring, it's unknown exactly what that amount is. So there may be $1 trillion sitting around that hasn't gone out the door. There may be $800 billion. Maybe it's a little bit more. We don't know the exact number, but that's something that the White House is working on producing. So Washington is obviously watching these talks very, very closely. But to be clear, they're talks among a very select group of members, and that's creating a process problem for most members of Congress that believe in a legislative process, do not like governing through a crisis, and really accommodating these massive bills that are thousands of pages long that cost trillions of dollars just because there's panic in terms of the pandemic that is clearly still spreading throughout America.
As you mentioned, there was the original CARES Act that was over $3 trillion. We've had several more so-called stimulus packages since then. Now they're talking somewhere between, say, $1 and $4 trillion. Where are all these trillions of dollars actually coming from?
Well, they are borrowed money, in theory, on paper, that someday we're going to have to pay back, right? And when you think, how do you pay back this massive debt and deficit that we've got? Our national debt is now $27 trillion. What do we do to pay that back? Well, it's either going to require strong, robust economic growth or major tax increases. And tax increases hurt the economy and will only exacerbate our debt and deficit issues, in my view. So we obviously want to see this pro-growth policy come forward. We want to see the size, scope, and cost of the federal government limited to a constitutionally limited government. And we want to see members of Congress actually prioritize money in times of an emergency. So if it means that we need to spend a couple billion dollars on urgent testing or development of a vaccine with the CDC, maybe we can afford to cut the budget in another area that just isn't a big priority for 2020, as most of the economy is still closed.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, typically we end with you telling us a little bit about the club, so let's do that now.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital, and Club for Growth Action is our super PAC that engages in independent expenditures in federal elections. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here. Congressional Democrats want to include a bailout of states that have suffered a drop in revenue due to the COVID-19 pandemic in the new stimulus bill. But Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains those states were in financial trouble anyhow and don't deserve a bailout.
The coronavirus pandemic has obviously been a major challenge for the federal government. And of course, we've already spent more than $4 trillion in coronavirus response and stimulus funds. And it looks like there may be more on the way if Congress can reach a deal. But one of the understated aspects of the pandemic has been the impact on state governments. Because, of course, the pandemic and the economic shutdowns that have come along with it have wrecked just about every means that states have to collect revenue. And that's what we're going to take a closer look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. We are, as I said, taking a look at how the COVID-19 pandemic has crushed state budgets and asking the question of whether a federal bailout of states is necessary. I think one place that you can look to see exactly why a federal bailout would be a mistake is the state of Utah. When it became clear that the pandemic was going to be a disaster for the state's tax revenue, lawmakers in Utah quickly got out their scissors. In June, the state legislature made more than $1 billion in emergency cuts. They slashed spending across more than 100 line items in the state's education and general funds. State Senate President Stuart Adams, a Republican, told the Salt Lake Tribune that the cuts were necessary as part of a short and long-term set of decisions that would sustain the state today while dealing with the uncertainties of tomorrow. That is, I think, the right approach. A month later, it appears that quick action and the willingness to make those tough decisions may have spared Utah some of the severe budget shortfalls that other states are almost certainly going to face. The Salt Lake Tribune reported last week that Utah's tax revenue doesn't seem to be declining as sharply as was initially feared, and lawmakers are now looking to restore at least some of those earlier cuts. And it probably helped that Utah had been preparing for a situation just like this. Once every 3 years, Utah is required by state law to conduct a budgetary stress test. And while some other states have similar requirements, Utah has one of the most thorough stress test programs in the country, according to the Pew Charitable Trusts, a nonprofit that encourages states to adapt more sound budgetary policies. The exercise that they go through every 3 years helped state leaders prepare for the budgetary distress that they saw from the pandemic, even though the pandemic itself, of course, was not something that anybody could see coming. It at least, the stress testing gave policymakers a head start in considering what tools they could use to close those budgetary gaps. Because, of course, COVID-19 was an unexpected and unprecedented challenge for state and federal policymakers. But even an economic downturn as severe as this one fell within the parameters that Utah's most recent economic stress test had used. And so when the pandemic hit, the state's legislative fiscal analyst projected a drop in tax revenue of between $1.7 and $4.6 billion over the next 5 years, and it quickly provided lawmakers with a prearranged menu of options for keeping the budget on track. Other states that were not prepared, other states that don't do that kind of regular stress testing, are faring far worse. Responding to the crisis is going to create a multi-year budget crisis unlike anything the state has faced since the Great Recession, is what Maryland Governor Larry Hogan told NPR this week. The Republican governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, has compared his state's budget situation to the bloody red wedding scene from Game of Thrones. If you're not familiar with that, think a lot of blood, or in this case, a lot of red ink. Expected budget shortfalls will equal around 20% of all state spending by June of next year, according to an analysis by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. The pandemic has basically hammered every source of revenue that states rely on. Income and sales taxes have fallen across the board, obviously, as the pandemic has kept people home and government economic policies have forced businesses to close. Western states that rely heavily on taxes based on the extraction of oil and other natural resources have been whacked by a huge slowdown in travel and the collapse of oil markets. And of course, a drop-off in tourism across the board has caused taxes on hotels, rental cars, and other services to crater. The Federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, that's the CARES Act, that was passed back in March, provided about $150 billion in emergency aid to states, but that money was earmarked for coronavirus response efforts specifically, things like testing for the disease and unemployment programs at the state level, and it can't be used just to plug normal run-of-the-mill budgetary holes created by a shortfall in tax revenue. So now Congress is debating plans for another coronavirus stimulus bill, a bill that has already cleared the House would bail out states to the tune of $1 trillion, but Senate Republicans are so far opposed to that effort. While some state officials are understandably keen on the idea of a federal bailout, many others are saying that it would be a mistake to pile more debt on the national credit card just to get states off the hook. In a letter to Congress last week, more than 200 state lawmakers, who are members of the American Legislative Exchange Council, said that bailing out states would be harmful to taxpayers, federalism, and ultimately the states themselves. And indeed, take another look at Utah. If lawmakers there can figure out how to effectively cut and manage their budget during a pandemic, why should Utah's residents have to pay for another state's mistakes? Now, of course, it's true that states don't have the unlimited borrowing authority that the federal government enjoys, and they have to at least nominally balance their books every year, but that's just another reason why they should be taking precautions to prepare for lean times. The Pew Charitable Trusts, for example, they suggest that states adapt more stress testing strategies like what helped Utah prepare for this pandemic. Few other states do that as well, but most of them do not. Pew also suggests that states build up budgetary reserves and avoid unsustainable future budgetary plans. Now, there is no state that is going to weather the COVID-19 pandemic without making some difficult decisions, but the revenue hit will be less severe and the recovery probably quicker in places that were already being thrifty and vigilant before the pandemic got here. And when this crisis passes, lawmakers would do well to remember that. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the pandemic and of the state and federal response to it at Reason.com. You can also check out my latest feature piece there on mail-in voting and some of the problems that are almost certain to happen in November as the country prepares to vote in a pandemic. Find all that at Reason.com, and you can catch me again right here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
A hearing into how Marxist radicals have hijacked legitimate protests was held this past week by U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says you likely didn't hear about it from the mainstream news media.
In a recent conversation with noted pollster and message maven Frank Luntz, he told me that hundreds of millions of dollars in donations to foundations believed to be associated with Black Lives Matter as a social justice movement. Yet much of that money is actually going to a Marxist organization openly and unapologetically committed to radical upset in our American society, ranging from replacing the nuclear family with villages to decriminalizing prostitution and all drug offenses, dismantling free market capitalism, and a scheme of reparations that goes far beyond compensation for slavery and is estimated to be in the tens of trillions of dollars, or roughly equal to the entire United States annual national economy. Then there's the matter of violence as an integral and justifiable part of organized social justice protests under the Black Lives Matter banner. Protests are constitutionally protected. The First Amendment refers to the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Note that it refers to peaceable assembly. This past week, Senator Ted Cruz, chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, held a hearing on that very issue. It provided a fascinating perspective from which to view the recent protests in Portland, Seattle, Philadelphia, Minneapolis, and several other cities. Are these constitutionally protected peaceful protests, or have they been hijacked by anarchists and turned into violent and unlawful riots that require police and other government intervention? If you saw or heard any news coverage of the Constitution Subcommittee's hearing, I will bet that you heard that Senator Mazie Hirono walked out of it, angrily criticizing Senator Cruz's rhetoric. My next bet is that you saw or heard no coverage of the substance of the hearing. So I want to invite you to listen to Senator Cruz's opening statement now.
When America saw the horrifying video of a police officer killing George Floyd, a brutal killing that evoked for many the nation's long history of racial discrimination and injustice, Americans rightly and peaceably assembled to demand justice, justice for every American, regardless of skin color. But what began as legitimate protests against a vile act of abuse, sadly, were soon hijacked by opportunists and violent radicals. By early June, rioters had injured more than 700 law enforcement officers across the country and had murdered David Dorn, a retired officer who served St. Louis with honor for many years. They also damaged or destroyed countless buildings and businesses. In Minneapolis alone, rioters burned affordable housing and damaged over 400 businesses, many of them owned by African Americans. At a cost of well over $500 million in damages. In Philadelphia, police cars were set ablaze. In Seattle, rioters who damaged hundreds of buildings were granted and allowed to set up a so-called autonomous zone by local officials who all too predictably resulted in more crime, including four shootings that cost two young people their lives. The fact is, the people who took the streets because their hearts cried out for justice have become overshadowed by rioters and looters and those who cynically exploit the protest for their own evil ends. And those rioters aren't concerned about racial justice. Indeed, they're willing to make a mockery of the peaceful protest to advance their violent objectives. Their actions are profoundly racist, the rioters, as they destroy minority communities, minority businesses, and minority lives across this country. This shouldn't be complicated. Peaceful protests must be protected. Riots must be stopped. No one has a right to assault another person, to firebomb a building, to throw a Molotov cocktail into a police car. That's not exercising a constitutional right. That is terrorizing your fellow citizens.
Who can object to Senator Cruz's careful distinction between the laudable sentiment behind much of the popular support for Black Lives Matter and the radical and criminal anarchy embraced by some of the organizations behind it? There wasn't much coverage of that because the narrative that the media want to promote is that Senator Cruz is divisive and that his hearing was demagogic. He isn't, and it wasn't. I thank American Radio Journal for allowing me the time to give you the substance that the major media failed to cover. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WXRQ-AM in Mount Pleasant, Tennessee. Welcome to our new listeners in the Volunteer State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.